the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by.
Hello and welcome to Education Now. I am your host, Athena Melville. In this September 5th edition, we welcome Alex Cajetani, California Teacher of the Year and author of the new book, Owning It. Alex holds a master's degree in educational curriculum and instruction and a bachelor's degree in sociology. Alex Cajetani works in one of San Diego County's poorest school districts. He was named California Teacher of the Year and a top four finalist for 2009 National Teacher of the Year. Alex is a leading authority on closing the achievement gap through practical, easy-to-implement strategies. His new book, Owning It, is a collection of 25 highly readable columns. It offers concrete strategies for teachers to experience success in every part of their job, in the classroom, at school, and throughout their communities. Owning It was named this month's recommended reading by the U.S. Department of Education. When not in the teacher trenches, Cajetani spends his free time with his wife and editor, Megan Pincus Cajetani, and their kids at the beach surfing. Which sounds so wonderful. I really enjoyed this interview, and I really loved the book. So enjoy, and I'll be back after the interview with contact information and more. Bye now. Enjoy. Hello, Alex Cajetani. It is such an honor to welcome you to Education Now.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here today.
I've told our listeners a good deal about you in the introduction to this interview, about your success teaching students who are at risk in the San Diego area. I told them about your TED Talk and your creation of the videos, The Rapid Mathematician, and your book, The Teacher of the Year Handbook. I have told them you were recognized as the California Teacher of the Year in 2009 and that you were one of the top four nationally. And I told them I had learned that your new book, Owning It, was recommended reading by the U.S. Department of Education.
Now, did you tell them that I was also, that I'm also a guest on Education Now with Athena Melville?
I did.
Yeah, because I certainly plan on adding that to my list of accolades. So thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, thank you, Alex. Well, first of all, can you tell us why you wrote Owning It?
Yeah, you know, I wrote Owning It because I really realized that being a teacher doesn't stop when we leave our classrooms at the end of the day. And in fact, being a teacher is really something that follows us out into the school parking lot and into the wider communities where we work and live. And so as a teacher today, we're constantly juggling a lot of different roles as classroom leaders and as colleagues on our campus and as what I call public professionals out in the wider communities. And so all of these roles really require different but intersecting skill sets. And so what I wanted was I wanted teachers and administrators to have a book that was based on real issues that we face as educators and one that also provides us with practical, high-leverage strategies that can be easily implemented, you know, as we go about owning all of these different roles that we play. Because really, you know, what I think is that teaching isn't just what we do, but teaching is what we are. And that's why I wrote Owning It, so that we would have something that we could pull out and use when the real situations come up that we face every single day as educators.
So it's really about authenticity.
It's about authenticity. It's about seeing that as issues come up, we have a couple of choices. We can sit around and complain about them. We can grumble, or we can sort of own those issues and say, all right, these are our issues as teachers and as a profession, and so we've got to do something about them. And so at the same time, I also know how busy teachers are, and they need practical strategies that they can use now. And so everything in the book is really designed to be easily implementable and you know, really something that you can see results from immediately, but at the same time, a little bit of inspiration also, or a lot of inspiration to know why we need to make these changes and why they're important to education and to our world.
Yes, I found the book really interesting and inspirational, and it's filled, I have it all filled up with notes everywhere.
Oh, good.
And I feel like you mentioned that, you know, a teacher doesn't have to just sit down and read the book straight through, that, you know, you just sit down and you pick it up and, you know, you can go to a certain section, you know. And I think that that's great, too, because we come home sometimes and there's a particular issue, and just if you look through those 25 steps that you have in there, you can go to something, instead of just reading it straight through, you can go directly to that section of the book.
Okay, yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that, because that is probably the number one comment that I've gotten from people who've read it so far, which is, you know, thank you for writing a book that I could, that I didn't have to read from cover to cover, and thanks for writing a book that I could sort of read deeply or skim if I needed to, and something that just kind of gets right to the point, because again, teachers and administrators are so busy these days that a lot of us need the information now in a format that's easy to digest and easy to understand as well.
Right. So you don't need a lot of justification or description or anything. You just need to go right to the point.
Yeah.
As a focus. So that really is telling us about the value of teachers, to teachers and administrators of this book. Can you tell us about the value of a teacher's personal learning philosophy? I found that particularly interesting, of course, because I agree with it, but could you tell our listeners about that?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. You walk up to any teacher and ask them why they became a teacher, and chances are they've got a pretty good answer for you. And some teachers like me, they always knew they wanted to be a teacher, or others had a great epiphany or transformative experience that maybe made them want to teach. But if you ask those same teachers why they're still teaching after 10 years, suddenly those reasons become much more varied and complex. Because what I think is, regardless of the reasons why we all got into teaching, why we stay in teaching actually depends on our own personal philosophy about teaching and learning. And the more well thought out your philosophy, the clearer you become on why you wake up every morning to do this incredible job each day. And not just in August when we're all fresh and excited, but, you know, also in February when we might be a bit burned out and tired. And so, you know, what I hope, and especially what I hope to promote with this book, is the opportunity for teachers to really think deeply on, you know, I've been teaching for 5 years or 10 years or 20 years. Why am I still doing it every single day? And to really get in touch with that philosophy and use it to drive you through every single moment that we're teaching.
Yeah. Yes, I agree. It needs to be a passion.
Absolutely.
And, yeah.
Absolutely.
And then also I really loved the way you talk about being personal and at the same time keeping limits in owning it. You know, it brings home that whole issue that freedom without limits is license.
Yeah.
Without responsibility, there really is no freedom.
Sure.
It's just license.
Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead. No.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it's important for teachers to remember really the difference between being friendly and being friends. And we can be friendly to our students, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we need to be friends with them. Now, this also doesn't mean that we're never going to end up being friends with them either, but while a child is a student in our class, I really think it's important to draw the distinction, especially, you know, most of my career I've been a middle school teacher, and so it's very important to draw the distinction that we're here to guide and to teach and to support our students, but we're not hanging out with them just for friendship's sake. And, you know, I'll tell you, with Facebook and Twitter and digital media being so prevalent in our lives these days, the line is getting blurrier and blurrier and harder to define each day. And so I believe it's up to us as the teachers to hold ourselves accountable to draw that line and make sure that the students know, hey, I'm a friendly person, you know, but I am not your friend. We may end up being friends later as a result of the teacher-student relationship, something like that. You know, I hope that, you know, a lot of my students will want to keep in touch with me, and certainly I'm still in touch with some of my former teachers, and I would consider them friends now. But while the student-teacher relationship is happening in the classroom, there's a line that needs to be drawn between being friendly and being friends.
Yes, it's very in many ways a teacher in my from my view is a guide and knows a great deal about psychology and interpersonal relationships. And when you're paying to see someone to talk about problems, or when you're paying to go to school, that is an indicator, you know, that keeps that limit there in a sense, because there's never any question about who came to whom for a service. But
yeah,
in public school, because it's all free, you know, that can get kind of confusing, and I think for some people. And so, but it's so important to keep that limit, especially when transference happens, which is going to happen whenever anyone is in a relationship with other people where they know a great deal about each other's lives. Once that happens, there's been some stuff in the news lately about a person, a teacher who had sexual relationships with a female student. And, well, you know, consenting? Doesn't that make a difference? And, you know, but then the whole thing gets lost, that line of, no, it is not okay ever. Not okay ever. It's just, it gets lost.
Exactly. And I think that the best thing that teachers can do in order to, never have it get to that point is essentially make sure that it never gets to that point by drawing that clear line early on and never letting it even be a possibility.
Being personable, keeping the limits. Yep.
Yeah.
Now, you also lay a great deal of stress on the first 5 minutes of class time.
Yes.
Could you talk about that? That was great. Really, I think, helpful for anyone.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite sessions in the book. And before I was in education, I actually managed a restaurant up in Santa Barbara, California. And in the restaurant business, the first 5 minutes of a customer's experience are the most critical. I mean, if you picture yourself walking into a restaurant that you've never been to, and let's say after walking in, you just stand there by the front door for 5 minutes, and nobody greets you, and nobody shows you to your seat or offers to put your name on a waiting list, and you're just standing there. And so you stand in there, you start to look around, and maybe you notice that the floor is filthy or that the music is too loud, or maybe some of the customers look unhappy. So I'll tell you what to do in that situation. You run, right? You leave immediately and go to another restaurant. And those first 5 minutes are critical, just as are the first 5 minutes in, say, a movie that you watch, or even when you first meet somebody, you begin to form that impression in your mind about how the experience is going to be. And so that same thinking is really something that we need to own in our classrooms as teachers. It's those first 5 minutes are an opportunity to connect with our students and set the tone, convey our expectations, and state in very clear terms why the class is even happening at all. And I really think that the number one thing that we can do as teachers to make sure that this happens is to greet every student at the door as they first walk in. And as simple or as obvious as that may seem, it's something that absolutely is essential. And it doesn't need to be a long conversation that you have with your students, maybe just a quick connection, or, you know, that both directly and indirectly says to the student, hey, I'm here at the door because this class is organized, this class is under control, and it's important that we're here today. Just like when you walk into a restaurant and the host greets you immediately and says, you know, welcome, this restaurant is organized, this restaurant is under control, we're glad that you're here today and you're going to have a great meal. Those first 5 minutes are absolutely critical.
And you talk about you can establish that just by making eye contact.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, eye contact is a skill that I found that I really have had to teach my students also. You know, that ability to maintain eye contact with somebody while you're first meeting somebody or while you're talking to somebody or while you're in an interview situation, things like that, is not necessarily a skill that all of our students come in with. And so finally, I found that it's a skill that we actually have to teach, is the ability to maintain eye contact. And that is a skill that our students need for, you know, every aspect of their life.
Yes, I totally agree with you, and I think it's especially hard for middle school students because they're at that self-conscious age. And so I think it drama was the way that the way that I would approach it is with using drama to bring out to do the eye contact.
Yeah, well, and you know, there's also there's a cultural aspect of that. For years, I'd be, you know, talking to my my Hispanic students, and you know, I'd be talking to them and saying, hey, you know, give me eye contact, give me eye contact. Can you look at me when I'm talking to you? Until one of my colleagues said, you know, heard me and said, hey, you know, in their culture, it's often considered disrespectful to maintain eye contact with a superior or, you know, with somebody in authority. And I kind of went, oh, oops, you know, I didn't know that. Now, that doesn't mean that I stopped insisting on eye contact. It just meant that I now was able to teach eye contact as a specific skill that our students need to be able to have. And I was able to say, hey, you know, it may be one way in your culture, but in this culture and in, you know, in the professional and academic worlds of this culture, being able to maintain eye contact is something that is very important. And so it was just something that we need to own and to teach.
Right. It carries that level of intimacy in some cultures that's not acceptable. If you are an underling.
Yeah.
You also stress the value of being positive. You know, when situations come up that, you know, a student continues to be late, a student constantly forgets their homework, that's hard. That can be hard to stay positive in those situations. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, it's funny because that is directly related to what we were just talking about with eye contact and needing to teach specific skills. Because a lot of times we assume that our students walk into our classrooms with all of the social skills necessary to be functioning members of society. And every beginning teacher quickly learns that not all of our students are going to walk into our classroom on the first day at grade level with all the academic skills that they were supposed to have learned in previous years. And yet somehow we often think that they do have the social skills that they need. And so it's really up to us to own this issue and teach our students the proper responses. And so a lot of times that also comes, you know, that also relates to things like getting your homework done. You know, it may be obvious to us as teachers that you're supposed to get your homework done every single night. And many teachers were excellent students themselves, so that's just something that is obvious, but it's not necessarily obvious to our students. And so, you know, for example, when you bring up the issue of a student not arriving with their homework, it's often in our natural reaction as teachers to say, you know, how come you didn't do your homework? But what the student actually hears is, quick, think of something to say to get the teacher out of my face as soon as possible. And so they're willing to spit out, you know, any old reason. Right. And one of my favorite quotes is actually by Zig Ziglar, who said, failure is an event, not a person. And what we need to do as teachers is we need to see a student who doesn't have their homework. You know, we need to really get to the solutions instead of potentially berating that student. And instead, you know, I encourage teachers to say something like, you know, well, if you could relive yesterday, what would you do differently in order to get your homework done? Or if you could change one thing about when and where you do your homework, what would that one thing be? Or even, what are the biggest obstacles to you not getting your homework done? And all three of these questions force the student to come up with a solutionary reason as to why they didn't do their homework. And a lot of times that solution is actually pretty easy to implement. A lot of times the students aren't getting their homework done because of maybe a logistical issue at their house or the inability to, you know, find somewhere quiet to work. And those things can be easily corrected by having them do their homework, you know, before they leave school each day, or even to being able to call a parent and say, hey, you know, Alicia really just needs 25 minutes of quiet in her house to get her homework done. Is that something we can arrange for her each day? The things that we think are obvious because we were generally very good students as teachers, we're generally very good students, there are some obvious things that aren't necessarily obvious to all of our students, and we've got to stay positive about that and look for solutions at the same time.
Yes, I love it, because you're turning a situation of excuses into a situation of solutions.
Mm-hmm.
And just by your approach, I think it's just, you know, wonderful. I know that I was in picking up my car one time, and I had known the family that runs this place for a while, and this woman came in, and she said to the young boy, it was summer vacation, who was sitting at the desk in his father's shop, have you been reading this summer? And, you know, he just lowered his head and didn't say anything, and then she shouted it out again, and he said, well, no, you know, and she just shook her head with disgust and walked out, and I just looked at him and I said, why do you let her talk to you like that?
Interesting.
To me, it was just so humiliating.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I just wonder how many people have that experience.
Yeah. And simple rule to follow, you know, if as a teacher, if your question ends the conversation, that's probably a question that you need to rethink, because, you know, something like, why didn't you do your homework, is usually something to end the conversation. But we've got to make sure that we're using questions that begin the conversation.
Yeah. Well, he told me she was his teacher.
As if I
would then understand that it was okay for her to be disrespectful.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him that I didn't think it was any excuse for that kind of behavior. Well, I especially enjoyed the section on understanding what ethnicity is, and that leads right, and why it's important to take this into consideration when designing lesson plans.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, ethnicity is one of my favorite subjects to talk about, because I truly believe that as educators, we have got to move past the discomfort of talking about race and ethnicity in our classrooms. And when I'm talking about ethnicity,
I so agree with you.
Yeah. And you know, when I'm talking about ethnicity, what I'm referring to is your affiliation with your race, your country of origin, your culture, your language and traditions, as well as basically all of the things that make you who you are and your culture, including your sexual orientation and all of the things that go into essentially making you who you are. And from time to time I hear adults say things like, well, I don't think we should need to talk about race, and, you know, we're all part of the human race and we should be a colorblind society. But what I truly have come to know is that to our students, race and ethnicity is an incredibly important part of who they are. You know, I had a student named David. He was, you know, one of my all-time best students ever, and he came in one morning and he said, oh, Mr. Kajitani, I'm so sorry, I didn't do my homework last night, but I'll get it done tonight, and I'll get it to you tomorrow. And I said, well, geez, David, what's going on? You usually have your homework done every day. He said, well, my uncle was working last night, and the immigration service, or who my students call La Migra, La Migra came in and they raided his work and they grabbed him and they put him on a bus and they hauled him back to Mexico. And so my aunt came over and she was freaking out all night. She couldn't get a hold of him. And so I couldn't get any of my homework done. I'm really sorry. And so to a student like David, race and ethnicity is extremely important because it determines whether or not a member of your family gets hauled away in the middle of the night. It determines whether or not you're ever going to be able to get a social security number and have a job or maybe even go to college. And so to our students, it's a really big deal. And the funny thing is, they're often very willing to talk about it. They want to explore these issues. They want to talk about these issues. And often it's us as educators who squash that conversation because we're a little bit uncomfortable with it. And so what we've got to really do is we've got to take that knowledge and those conversations about race and ethnicity, and we can actually use it and put it into the curriculum in order to help our students really achieve academically. And what we've got to do is actually stop trying to take our curriculum and try to force it into our students' lives and instead take our students' lives and fit it into the curriculum. And so, you know, let me give an example of that. Once as a unit on percentages, I asked my students to identify their race. And then what we did is we calculated what percent of our class was white or black or Latino, et cetera. And then I pulled up our school's website and we compared those percentages from our class with our overall school's percentages. And then we followed that up with percentage comparisons of our county of San Diego and then even the state of California. And when we did this, the percentages were no longer a set of unconnected numbers and math symbols, but instead the students saw themselves in those numbers and they instantly started making connections to themselves and to their lives. And I think it's important for teachers to remember that talking about race and ethnicity is not racism. It's only when we act badly towards someone because of their race or ethnicity does it actually become racism. And that's really important. Talking about it is not racism. It's only when we act badly towards someone because of it where it becomes racism. And that's an important distinction to make both within ourselves and within our classrooms.
Oh, that is so just beautiful. Thank you for that. It's one of the things that's frustrated me the most. In our private school, we had this unit on yourself, and the whole thing was to honor who you are and to see how the mythology and of what we got down to was, even though there was this great diversity in our group in ethnicity, there were all these connections mythologically, and it's a whole person instead of like burying all those beautiful roots and ancestors in this blandness that some people think of as, oh well, let's not talk about race, let's not use the race card. Well, thank you so much for that. Thank you so much for...
Oh, sure. Yeah, the key is really to incorporate those differences instead of eliminate them.
Yes, yes. Okay, now, this one is near and dear to me, this question. The value of involving parents in the process, especially students in high-risk environments.
Yeah, parent involvement, you know, is what we often call the missing link for many of our students, you know, especially our at-risk students. And, you know, what I found is that if you can communicate with parents just a little bit, but on a regular basis, you can actually turn even your most challenging student into a part of your classroom culture. And maybe not, you know, maybe not every single student. There are just going to be some parents that are going to remain uninvolved throughout their students' education. But what I think is that it's really a part of our job as teachers to help bridge gaps within families as well as at school. And like I said earlier, what I found is that even if you can communicate with parents just a little bit, but on a regular basis, that's much more effective than really trying to track down one parent to come in for a long conversation or conference. And so What I did was, after countless attempts to reach parents at home, what I started doing was I started getting their cell numbers at the beginning of the school year, because you know, everybody seems to have a cell phone these days, and at the beginning of the school year is the best time to get everybody's cell phone number, because that's when parents think, you know, oh, nothing's going to go wrong this year. I'm very hopeful. So, you know, of course, here's my phone number. And what I started doing is I started actually texting them whenever I need to communicate with them. And so I just send short texts with anything from, you know, Jose got an A on his math test, or Jenny got a detention and needs to stay after school. And I'm able to just communicate with them instantly and on the spot. And, you know, a lot of teachers, they're worried about using their own cell number. And so if that's the case, what I recommend is there's a great website called Remind 101. It's the word remind101.com. Mm-hmm. And what you can do is you can actually sign up and send a text without your number being shown. And you can also send out text message blasts to all of your parents all at once. And so, actually, I have to admit, I came up with this idea of sending texts because I was trying to arrange a dinner with a friend of mine, and you know, I called him and said, "Hey, give me a call back. We'll hook up for dinner. We'll make a plan." And for like 3 days, he didn't call me back. But what I noticed is that he'd been very active on Facebook over those 3 days. And so I got a little bit offended, and I thought, man, he's got all this time to be on Facebook, but he can't even call me back. And then what I realized is, hey, wait a minute, why don't I just send him a Facebook message? And lo and behold, I sent him a Facebook message, and within 30 minutes, we had a dinner plan. And so I think that we've got to, as teachers, just own the fact that people are communicating in very different ways. Very short, convenient bursts of communication seem to be the way that people are preferring to communicate these days, and we've got to just adjust to that. And most parents do have cell phones, even the ones in the, you know, the lower income neighborhoods where I work, and so it's just a good, easy way to stay in touch with them. And again, staying in touch a little bit, but regularly, is I found to be much more effective than trying to have that one long conversation or conference.
Right. That's wonderful. I that was a real light bulb for me, that section, because of course I always wanted, like, how can I get this parent in for an hour conference?
Yeah.
You know, and so it was like, oh, how great, you know, I mean, if you could have this instant, like, just a message, like, you know, this, like this, it would be just perfect, just beautiful. I love that. And yep. I feel for your friend who was on Facebook, and you wanted to have dinner with, but I love it that you weren't offended and didn't keep going for the dinner.
Well, we've got to own it, right?
Right. But, you know, I'm on Facebook, and I'm doing reflections for my students, which will remain private. But if a person looks on my Facebook, they'll say, oh, Athena's on Facebook. You know,
yeah.
But I'm not, you know, I don't care how many times it dings, I'm not available. I'm focusing on this reflection.
Mm-hmm. That's yeah, funny.
It is.
Yeah, somebody asked me once, well, what's the best way to get a hold of parents? And I said, you know what, there is no one best way. There are 5 or 10 best ways, and you've just got to find the one that works.
Yes, there you go. Always staying creative in the process.
Yeah.
Well, now I'm very familiar with student-led conferences and giving students choices, which you talk about in the book, which I also loved, because they're part of Montessori education. Can you talk about these concepts and the value of empowering students?
Oh, definitely. I devoted a section in Owning It to student-led conferences, and this is a section that I co-wrote with a superb fourth-grade teacher named Mindy Crum. And what we do is we lay out an easy-to-follow 7-step plan so that teachers can implement these student-led conferences in their own classes. And having done both of them in our classes, both Mindy and I really have found that student-led conferences really give the students an opportunity to become empowered and engaged and allow the students to take an active role in their own learning and development. And you know, again, it comes down to that thing that great teachers do, which is that they, as often as possible, demand less and less of themselves and more from their students. And so this is an opportunity to give our student, you know, really to train them to lead their own conference and give them at the same time some crucial life skills that are, you know, really critical to academic and career success. I mean, it essentially teaches them how to run a good meeting. And, you know, if, as educators, we've all sat in meetings run by somebody who could use more and more of these skills. And so I highly encourage anyone listening to check out that section and owning it. It has completely transformed the way that I think of student conferences by actually putting the students in charge of their own conference. And another beautiful bonus about all of that is if you have students whose parents may not speak English, the students are doing the translating, and so it's another valuable life skill that for many students can end up being a very marketable skill. But that concept of putting the students in charge of their own learning is something, obviously, that that Montessori education has known about for a long time, but also something that I think just pays huge dividends when it comes to our students grasping, you know, real knowledge and academic content.
Right. And having and that skill flowing down to students who are at risk, that's what I love so much about this because the student I was telling you about, if he could have just spoken back to this woman, not in a disrespectful way, but just the self-concept to you know, the independence to deal with a situation, and that's what's being given is, you know, a step towards independence when a student leads their own conference and when they have choices in the classroom.
I think that's also one of the unintended consequences that has happened with the way that we structure public education is that, you know, we have students essentially sit in rows with people their own age all day long, and in no company in the world or none that I know of do they say, you know, welcome to your first day on the job. What we do here is we sit in rows and we communicate with only people who are exactly our own age. You know, the way that the world really works is that we've got to be able to communicate with people younger than us, older than us, you know, of different cultures than us and things like that. And so this is just, these student-led conferences are one opportunity and a very significant opportunity for our students to get some experience talking to people of all different ages and being in charge of people of all different ages. Even if those people are our teachers and family members, it's a crucial skill that our students need, which is that ability to communicate and to speak publicly in front of a group.
Yes. My screen is kind of jumping about. If we lose connection, I'll call you back.
Okay.
But it will take me a little bit of time to reconnect. But I'm
no
just
problem.
Hoping it doesn't happen because it's just so great so far. So, Alex, let's go on then. Some of your ideas about the way teachers can support each other. I think you've talked a little bit about that. But do you want to add anything to that idea?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the first thing that we really can do is to make every effort to support our new teachers. You know, the National Education Association estimates that 20% of teachers in urban schools leave each year, with many of them leaving within the first 3 years of their teaching. In the book, I talk about a teacher that I taught with named Brenda, just one of the most promising young teachers that I've ever met. And what she did was she told me that when she first got to the school, she got her first job. She was super excited. It was in a school in a low income neighborhood with pretty high teacher turnover. And she said those first 6 months, all of the teachers just kind of ignored all of the other teachers in the school kind of ignored her until she finally, you know, said to one of the teachers, gosh, I feel like the teachers really don't want anything to do with me here. And the teacher actually said to her, well, we see so many new teachers come and go that basically what we do is we just sort of, you know, leave you on your own for the first year. And if you actually survive and come back that second year, then we know that you know you're serious about working here. And I mean, what an absolutely detrimental approach to encouraging and keeping our new teachers in the profession. And that's just an attitude, and that's a part of the teaching and the education culture that we've got to turn around. And so I've got a lot of, again, easy to implement, just real strategies that teachers can utilize in order to help new teachers stay in the profession. And it's one of my favorite titles for the section, and it's Welcome to Teaching, Please Stay. And that's just something that we've got. Otherwise, we're really in risk, in fear of, you know, losing an entire generation of teachers. And, you know, the ones that are leaving are already leaving in, you know, too quickly and in droves, and the ones that are staying really need some extra support. And but the new teachers aren't the only ones who need ongoing support. And one of my other favorite sections in the book is really devoted to real strategies to help teachers from different generations, you know, work with and support each other, first by understanding the different generations and the characteristics that make each generation unique, and then by acknowledging and really celebrating the generational differences openly. If we don't, we run the risk of the newest generation of teachers who are very technologically savvy, for example, getting frustrated with the veteran teachers who might not be as technologically savvy, and that's just not going to be good for a school culture. And so as we put time and resources into supporting new teachers, I think it's very important to put time and resources into supporting, you know, mid-career and veteran teachers as well, because there's this myth in teaching that it gets easier every single year, and the truth is it gets harder, and it doesn't necessarily get harder each year, but teaching is hard every single year, and every single year we've got a new set of students walking into our classrooms that are influenced by the latest technology or television show or attitude that seems to be permeating society. And so we've got to be able to adjust, and that doesn't necessarily get easier from year to year. And so we've got to make an effort to support all of our teachers across the board.
It doesn't get easier, especially when they keep cutting budgets and increasing class sizes and requiring more testing and all of those things. It's hard to stay positive. And also, I think that with a Teach for America kind of program, a lot of those teachers are coming in not because they want to be teachers, but as a sort of feel-in on their way to someplace else that they feel passionate about. And so, you know, as well as it's being difficult for some teachers, I think also some teachers are teaching not because they really love teaching right now. That. You know, I don't want to I don't want to go to the negative, so I'll drop it.
Well, that's okay, because again, I think what it comes back to is the very first thing that we talked about, which is your own personal teaching and learning philosophy. Which
yes.
is if you have a solid grounding in why you wake up every morning, then you're going to be not only a much more effective teacher, but also a happier person that's helping to create a happier student and a better society.
Yeah, that's right. As you say in your chapter on teaching teachers, you talk about being prepared and flexible, going early, and learning by doing and connecting the dots, and having fun.
That's right.
Ah, so wonderful.
You know, one of the things that I really do is encourage teachers to step up and contribute to the profession by presenting at conferences or even to their school staff about strategies or programs that they found to be very effective. You know, I truly believe that all of the knowledge that we need as educators in order to improve our schools already exists within the building. And I think that a lot of times the real key is we don't necessarily need to bring the outside experts in. We need to bring the inside experts out. And even though, you know, we're in front of kids all day, a lot of teachers are hesitant to get up and present in front of their colleagues. And so what I do in owning it is I map out the five essential things that presenters need to do. And some are obvious, like being prepared if your technology suddenly should stop working. And some are not so obvious, like really paying attention to how the participants react to what you're presenting and how to fix it so that each time you present, it gets better and better. And like you said, of course, I always encourage presenters to have fun and to realize that each time you present, your classroom just gets bigger and bigger. And, you know, I mean, I love teaching a class of 30 students, but when I speak to 30 teachers who each have 30 students, now my classroom consists of 900 students. And that's really something that that I get excited about.
Yeah, that is exciting. Thank you so much for that. That's a wonderful part of the book, and I just love it that you laid stress on that. Now, you dedicated the last chapter or segment to the importance of blogs.
Ah, yes.
And so I really wanted the listeners to hear your take on, to hear you talk about that.
Yeah, blogs, which is short for web logs, which, you know, have really a form of an online journal. But blogs have become really an important part of the dialogue surrounding education these days. And I remember once when someone first asked me about what I thought of the new Common Core standards, I sort of mumbled and realized I didn't really have an answer yet. And so what I did was I immediately ran to my computer and looked up some of the popular bloggers in order to get other people's opinions on them and in order to start forming my own. And I suggest in the book some just absolutely must-read blogs for educators. There's a list of them in there and some brief descriptions on ones that that I really feel are critical for educators to be reading. But, you know, as much as I think that it's important to read other people's blogs, I also think that they're a great opportunity for us as teachers to be heard and to let our teacher voice be heard. And so what I do is I outline how to start your own blog and some great suggestions on how to use it to build your own platform and how to gain an audience and things like that. And that's because, you know, in this educational and political climate, I really think teachers need to own the fact that we're not just teachers in our classroom, but we are public professionals who society turns to for information about our children. And that's why the third section of Owning It is really devoted to us as public professionals. We don't stop being teachers. We don't stop representing the teaching profession when we leave our schools. I mean, we are teachers talking about education to the parent who's pushing their kid on a swing next to us on Saturday morning when we're pushing our own kids, and when we're sitting at soccer games and somebody wants to know something about education. We've got to own this role as classroom leaders, as colleagues on our campuses, and you know, as public professionals. And that's why I hope that everybody will really get this book, and I hope that everybody can learn from it.
I think everyone can, and I think that, you know, one of the things that I love about the ability for people to hear your voice and when promoting this book is that they can hear the passion in your voice, and at least I can, and how you are owning it, Alex.
Excellent. Well, thank you.
Yeah. How can a person get your new book, Owning It?
Well, there's two places. It's available on my website, which is alexkajitani.com. That's alexkajitani.com, or at owningitbook.com.
Great. And I will repeat both of those websites at the outgo. So if listeners didn't hear it the first time, they'll hear it at the outgo of this interview. Now, if persons were interested in obtaining your book, The Teacher of the Year Handbook, same process?
Yep, that's also available on my website, alexkajitani.com.
Great. Now, I found your the Rapping Mathematician videos fascinating. And I've recently had a teacher, you know, tell me that they were looking for them, and I was just so amazed and struck by the synchronicity. If persons wanted to obtain copies of the Rapping Mathematician videos, how should they proceed?
Not surprisingly, they're also available on alexcajetani.com or at mathraps.com. That's M-A-T-H-R-A-P-S, mathraps.com.
Mathraps.com.
Yes.
Great. Now, I myself saw your TED Talk. And I know that listeners that are interested can access it by going to YouTube and just asking for Alex Cajetani's TED Talk, right?
Yep, it's also just been recently put right on the homepage of my website, alexcajetani.com, so you can, you know, that's your one stop for all things Alex Cajetani now. But you can, it's right there at the bottom of the homepage, and you can check it out. And that was just one of the best experiences I've ever had speaking, because in 14 minutes and 32 seconds I talk about, the title of my TED Talk is Making Math Cool, but really it's about just connecting with students, engaging in what they truly believe is important in education, and creating a better world.
Yeah. Well, your coping skills in the teacher trenches are amazing. And, your ability to deal with situations that many would find hopeless is just so... I'm just awed by it and delighted with your success. But I still want the best of all possible solutions. And for me, that would be one where parents were involved in their children's education from preschool, and the preschool would have mandatory parent education classes as well as parent involvement in the preschool, and that all families would have food and adequate shelter. Because I believe that with their needs met, the children and the families would be empowered and blossom. So
I think this sounds like an idea for your next book.
Well, I think that that book has already been written. I have actually, you know, in more affluent areas, I have been to these preschools. You know, they're parent co-ops, and they have a professional that's, you know, administering, and it's just incredible what happens, and it's incredible when you follow the kids out of that situation, how they blossom. But it's in the areas where you're working, in these high-risk areas, that's where it's not happening. It could happen if people really supported Head Start and programs like that. But at any rate, until then, it remains a dream. I thank you so very much for your time. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we say goodbye and I give you back to your family?
Well, I just, thanks to all the educators out there who are just working tirelessly every single day. Like I said, I truly believe that the key to improving education and continuing to do the great things that we're doing comes from, not from bringing the outside experts in, but from bringing the inside experts out. And I do believe that all of the answers that we need are within us and among us. And again, that's exactly right, why I wrote the book Owning It. So thank you so much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, thank you. Bye now, Alex.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
I hope all of you enjoyed Alex Cajetani as much as I did. His passion and purpose are just so exciting for me, and I'm so thrilled that he will be passing that on to his students. Well, websites, I want to tell you again for Alex Cajetani, although he told us in the interview, I want to repeat them again. You can get his book, Owning It, and his book, The Year of the Teacher of the Year Handbook, on his website, www.alexcajetani.com/owningit. And that's all one word, alexkajitani.com, or just at www.alexkajitani.com. And those are two of his sites. Making Math Cool, Alex Kajitani's TED Talk, you can access by going to YouTube and asking for Making Math Cool, Alex Kajitani TED Talk, or just TED Talk, Alex Kajitani. You can get there in a variety of ways. The Rapping Mathematician videos, which are so wonderful, you can access at no3w's just /alexkajitani.com/videos HTML, but they're also on the websites that I gave you, the alexkajitani.com /owningit and the alexkajitani.com. Well, I thank him once again, and it was just inspiring for me to see someone who's working with students in high-risk areas using a Montessori's method of following the child, empowering the child, student-led conferences. It just was so exciting for me, and I thank him. Well, you can listen and download free anytime at the website, and please join us on the Education Now Facebook page or our Google Plus page to leave comments and join the conversation. And if you leave a comment on the Facebook page or the Google Plus page for Alex, believe me, I will see that he gets it. Education Now is a production of the Hermeneutic Institute for Holistic Health and Education, a 501c3 nonprofit corporation. Education Now is a proud supporter of the American Montessori Society. Their website is www.amshq.org, and they have a Facebook page, just www.facebook.com/American Montessori Society. I'm sending you all much cosmic love and asking you to follow the child. Please follow the child. Thank you. Until next time. This is Athena Melville, your host, saying goodbye for now.
You, who are on the road, must have a code that you can live by. And so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by. And feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know.